Andre Dubuque III is the author of 8 books, including the New York Times bestsellers House of Sand and Fog, The Garden of Last Days, his memoir Townie, and Gone So Long. His new novel is Such Kindness. The novel asks us to reconsider our ideas about success and failure, our impulse to dismiss the struggles of those whom we perceive to be losers, and to reckon with a post-industrial society that has made townies and hillbillies into archetypes to be pitied and reviled rather than seen for the complex human beings that they are. Dubuque will be a featured speaker at the Provincetown Book Festival on Saturday, September 21st at 6 p.m. Again, his new novel is Such Kindness, and it's a pleasure to welcome Andre Dubuque III. Thank you so much for being with us.
Joe, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for that lovely introduction about that book.
The book is so beautiful. It's a hard story, right? I mean, it's a story about someone who is just getting by and having trouble and is making some good decisions and making some bad decisions. We usually often read about either the really low or the really high. And here we sort of have this individual who's right there on the verge of one way or the other. Was that always the intention?
No, you know, I try not to have any intention at all when I write fiction other than to show up daily and try to get some words on the page. But, you know, I mean, for me, the creative fuel that I find most helpful is just a non-judgmental curiosity about a situation. And I've come to trust over the years what I'm curious about. And I should back up, you know, before I became a writer who made my living at it and then a college professor, I was a self-employed carpenter. I was a bartender. I did all sorts of physical labor. And I think really, Joe, the question that began this novel for me was, what if my writing life never took off? What if I was still, you know, I'm in my 60s now. What if I was still working with my hands? And what if I got hurt? You know, I mean, all of my life, you know, until I began teaching in my 30s, I had only worked at jobs where, you know, if you don't work a day, you don't get paid for that day. And so what happens if you get sick? You don't get paid. And that was the question. What if I got hurt and I wasn't able to pay my bills at this age with a family? And that began my exploration of Tom Lowe Jr., the main character.
Tom is unemployed as a carpenter and has this chronic injury that he received while working, and that prevents him from doing the work that he's good at, but he really likes it. He enjoys that work.
Yeah, he began working on construction sites as a teenager, and he fell in love with the labor, and he really got good at it. So much so he was able to build his family home himself for his wife and child. But, you know, one of the things I discovered about him was that he always thought he'd be going on to do something else. And I think that's probably true of a lot of us. We stumble into something when we're younger and then we get good at it. And it's kind of hard to change horses midstream and do something else in the marketplace. But, you know, he went to 2 community colleges and 3 state schools. And he's based on a few guys I know who have a lot of college credits, but went into the trades and never left the trades. But yeah, you're right. He loves it, but you know, he falls off a roof, gets addicted to painkillers, is in chronic pain, and probably will never work as a carpenter again. And so what does he do now? Who is he now? What is his purpose in this world? As you know, that's where we begin the book.
It's where you begin the book, and it's not too far in the book when we realize the strains that his addiction puts on the relationship with his son, and keep the momentum moving, which is really in many ways unthinkable and yet so common.
Yeah, we discover early in the book, when the novel begins, Tom's been in, you know, clean and sober in recovery from drug addiction for 6 years. But when he was laying up in bed, you know, at home with his failing marriage and his house under foreclosure, he would send his 12-year-old son, Drew, out into the woods to meet a guy in a van to sell him opioids. This is something he did to his son. He made him his own little drug runner. And it's one of the, you know, one of the many emotional detritus items he has to deal with. Now that he's sober and his son is now 20 years old. He's turning 20 years old and Tom just wants to go see him. But early on in the novel, we discover his car has been towed because he was driving it without a license and registration. He's living in subsidized housing. He calls it the Eight. He feels like he doesn't belong there. He's a worker. What am I doing with these people in subsidized housing? But he does begin to change his view, doesn't he?
He certainly does. Did you always know how that view was going to change, of how he was going to mature, of how he was going to evolve?
No, it was a lovely surprise to me. As the novel begins, as you know, in the opening scene, Tom Lowe, who's 54 years old, is stealing the trash of the banker who sold him an adjustable rate mortgage, which is one of the things that led to Tom's financial demise around 2008. He's stealing the trash of his former banker to steal credit card information and steal from the man who he feels stole from him. So as I'm writing all this, you know, drama and petty crime, you know, the feeling in the back of my mind is the novelist is, well, Jesus, is this going to go somewhere dark and violent? Is he going to take this banker hostage? He's going to get really unhinged. And fairly early in the novel, Joe, Tom Lowe, the main character, sort of shrugs me off and says, look, I'm not going to be in one of your dark, violent little novels, Andre. No, I'm not that kind of guy. I'm going over here. And it was such a, I know this sounds bizarre because, you know, I created this guy, but then they create themselves. And I found over the years, and this is one thing I try to teach in creative writing classes, you know, if you just write with real authentic curiosity and without any agenda for what kind of book you want to write or where you want it to go, these characters will start to take on some agency of their own. So no, to answer your question, long-winded answer, I did not see his spiritual transformation is what happens to him. I did not see that coming, and it was a joy to follow once I discovered it.
So as you get to know the character and you perhaps think Tom is going to go right and he goes left, how long does it take for you to catch up with that and say, oh, okay, here we go?
I try to follow it beat by beat, sentence by sentence. But once, I've never piloted a big ship, but it's as if the ship is now going to turn, you know, 60 degrees this way. You got to do it slowly, depending on the weather. Right. And that's how I felt. I felt, okay, we're going over here. There is a few days, maybe even a week of sort of a psychic emotional adjustment in me. Okay, this is going to be a different kind of story, different colors, different instruments are coming in. All right, let's receive it. Let's receive it.
In the relationships, there is such an interesting group of people that are around Tom, that live around him, work around him, are around him. And you have this cast of characters, which obviously all have their faults. They all have their pluses as well. And it's really interesting because we sort of see how Tom is doing by kind of how well they're doing, right?
Yeah. You know, the word that comes to me is engagement. I've got some fine actor friends. And, you know, so often they'll talk about acting is really two parts. One is, yeah, you got your lines you perform. But it's almost just as important, if not more so, to listen, to be in the moment as the other actor is doing his work. And so I find that very helpful as a writer. Yeah, as Tom engages with the people around him, beginning with his 27-year-old, you know, single mother of three kids from three different boys, Trina, he reveals himself. He reveals himself by how he behaves with her. And of course, As the writer, not only do I get to follow him in terms of what he says and does, but also what's he thinking? What's he feeling? What's he remembering? What's his feeling about this woman living next to him? And that's very revealing. And it gave me a lot to work with.
When you have a lot to work with, how do you put it through the funnel in the sense of knowing where you're going to rely on?
Yeah, it's revision. So I'll allow myself. I finally figured this out about myself after all these years of writing fiction. I tend to just overwrite. You know, back in the 70s, bodybuilders would bulk up all year long, and then they chisel down 40, 50 pounds before their competition. And I tend to overwrite a big bloated novel in order to find all those moments. You know, it's a great line from John Updike. He says, the writer paints five doors on the wall, but only one will open. So I write all those scenes. I paint all those doors on the wall. And then it's in the rewriting, Joe, that I find the funnel, to use your word choice, this is the most essential moment. This is the truest moment, and it leads to this truer moment. So everything else gets cut.
I don't want to simplify this, which I feel I'm doing a little bit on this question, but there are many aspects to Tom's character where he could turn out to be somebody that we don't like. Right. But he is very likable. We feel for this guy. We worry about this guy. What is it about him that elicits that from us, if you agree with the premise of the question? And then in real life, why do we tend not to be as empathetic?
I tend to rail against this notion that a character has to be likable, and only because I've had so many former students who have written beautiful books, and then the editors at the publishing houses won't publish it because the character is not likable enough or relatable enough, as if literature is a first date with somebody. So I take pride in just, not pride, but I work hard on just trying to create real people, fully dimensional real people who are recognizable. And so that's what I try to do with Tom Lowe Jr. I will say that I think what makes him likable, here's what I'm trying to say. It's been a pleasant surprise to me that a lot of readers have already reached out to me and said he's very likable and they're rooting for him, which has not always been the case with my characters. But I think in this case, I think that they see that despite, you know, his drinking habit to kill his pain, to stay off the opioids, despite his harsh judgment of Trina and other people living in Section 8 with him, despite his bitterness towards his ex-wife and his neglect of his son, his heart's in the right place. You can see that, if nothing else, this man has been a worker his whole life, maybe to a fault, and now he can't. And I think there's a part of all of us that know that there, but for the grace of God, go I. I mean, you know, we're all just an accident away from a disaster. And so I certainly feel that way. But your second question is I think really important. You know, I read a very influential book for me back in college, which is in the 70s and early 80s. And it's a book of sociology by Philip Slater, the sociologist, and it's called The Pursuit of Loneliness. And in that book, what he says is, look, America is a competitive culture. And so it breaks its citizens down into winners or losers. And then he makes a profoundly wise point. He says, if you live in a culture that breaks its citizens down into winners or losers, as opposed to, say, a more communal culture, more cooperative culture, those cultures are therefore more obsessed with appearance. Do I appear as if I'm losing? Do I appear as if I'm winning? And of course, that's rampant materialism, the love of money and acquisition of objects, et cetera. I think the reason, in general, we human beings are not empathetic with our homeless brothers and sisters on the street, those of us living in Section 8 housing, poor people, is we're afraid we're going to catch the disease of poverty. It's been drilled into us that your point on the planet, the reason you're here, is to be happy. And the only way to be happy is to be successful. And in America, that's material. There's a wonderful book by Matthew Desmond, nonfiction book called Poverty by America.
Yes.
He won the Pulitzer for his book, Evicted.
Evicted, right.
I highly recommend Poverty by America. I read it after writing Such Kindness, but you know, he and I did a talk together because both books seem to address the same issue. I think that, you know, let me just speak for another second about his book. He considers himself a poverty abolitionist. He makes it very clear there's no reason why poverty should exist in the most, you know, in this, the most wealthy country in the world. The only thing that happened was the rich paid their fair share and corporations paid their fair share of taxes. We could abolish poverty. My view, Joe, to answer your question, I think there's a part of us as a culture, as a people, that actually likes poverty to exist as long as it doesn't happen to us. because we are still so indoctrinated in this winners versus losers thing that we feel it makes us feel better. Well, at least, hey, you know, I don't, you know, I live in a little ranch house on a quarter acre, but at least I'm not that guy. And I think there's some psychic payoff to us being able to judge someone less than us, materially speaking, less than us. And I think that's one of the stumbling blocks to us all becoming poverty abolitionists and getting rid of poverty completely. And this is also personal for me. I grew up with a poor single mom. I grew up in scarcity. It's not theoretical for me. I grew up with a mom. She either was going to pay the rent on time or we'd have heat. She's either going to put gas in the car to go to work or we're going to get groceries. We can't do both, on and on. So, you know, a lot of my own upbringing in scarcity, I think, informed my trying to capture Tom Lowe's dire straits.
Tom writes a letter late in the novel, and it says, "I don't know what forgiveness is. I never have, but I'm trying to learn. I'm trying to learn whatever I can." And I was struck by that because that seems to just be the MO of this character throughout, of okay, I may not get there, but boy, I'm trying.
Yeah, amen, man. I'm so glad that it's speaking to you in that way. You know, I was scared about writing this novel, and I'm always terrified starting the new novel. You know, you never know. It's just all about failing. But one of the risks I took was it's the first novel I've written from just one point of view. But I'm so glad I did, because Tom Lowe took over. And when he took over, I found that he was really taking me to compelling places like that, like what is forgiveness and how can I, what can I put my hands to if I don't have a body anymore that can work the way it used to? How can I be more present today, tonight? How can I be, you know, alive while I'm alive? And he became compelling company for me every morning when I went down to that cave to see what would happen with him next.
Such Kindness is the name of the novel by Andre Dubuc III. It is out from Norton. I find it different reading your fiction now, having read Townie. Better, but it almost gives it a context. And I don't know whether you ever intended that or not, but
Go ahead.
But it's your memoir, and it's fascinating, and it's beautiful, and it's stunning, and it's hard, at least for me, when I'm reading Such Kindness, it's hard to shake that book.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that, because one of my fears of when I realized I was writing a memoir and I realized it was going to be a book, one of my fears was, let me back up. Remember when Sean Penn was married to Madonna?
Yeah.
He used to beat up the paparazzi. And I used to think, come on, man, you're a movie star. Get used to it. It's part of your job. And then I heard him in an interview. He said, no, you don't understand. I don't want people, when they see me in a role, to think of Sean Penn married to Madonna. I want them to only see that guy. And that really, I had more respect for him after that. I said, okay, I get it. He wants to lose himself in the role. He doesn't want the audience to be polluted with this notion of Sean Penn, the man. Well, I had a similar fear. Okay, if you're going to publish a memoir as a fiction writer, you're parting that curtain and you're opening it to the author and to the private life. And you know, whenever I'm writing fiction, I not only do I want the reader to forget me, the writer of that story, I want them to forget they're reading a piece of fiction and they're in the world. I want them to just be in the world that I work so hard to evoke. But since publishing Townie, I've heard that from a lot of people, Joe, and it's just something that I'm going to have to live with. I'm okay with it. I'm proud of that book, Townie. I tried to get really naked and as honest and raw as I could in that story of my youth. But, you know, Gone So Long, my most recent novel, you know, had a nice review in the New York Times, but the reviewer only talked about Townie. Never talked about this book I spent 5 years on.
Well, that's interesting, because for me, in reading this book, it gives you, I mean, for want of a better term, like the cred, right, to write it. It's not that it haunts it. It's just that it informs it, that it's sort of, when I think of you as the writer, which is rarely as I'm reading it, I know that you know this character very well.
Yeah, and I'm okay with that. I am okay with that. Like I'm thinking about Faulkner, say, you know, he wrote, you know, his own Yoknaw Potawatomi County. Well, that's all right around Oxford, Mississippi. And that's, you know, we knew this is his territory. Of course, the writing was such that he had great veracity and verisimilitude. We know that, okay, these are people from the rural Mississippi, you know, land. And yeah, that's fine. Yeah, that's Faulkner country. And we know that's where he's from. I stand by my memoir and I stand by what I showed about myself and my family in it. Because we do come from, you know, we remember the educated working poor. And one of the things that Tom Lowe Jr. is he's a reader. He's gone to 5 colleges. He's never gotten a degree. And I know a guy, same situation. He has enough credits for like 2 bachelor's degrees, but he just never finished. He was always, and he's been a handyman. He's in his 70s and he's a handyman. And, but he's one erudite, well-read handyman.
As you're writing the story and you realize where Tom is headed, does that have to be in concrete or is that a moving target?
Dr. O said it best. He said, writing a novel is like driving at night. You can only see as far as your headlights, but if you keep going, you'll get there. And for me, I can see as far as my headlights. And the truth is, if I even, Joe, begin to have a sense of where it's going in the next 20, 30 pages, I freak out. I say, no, I know too much. I can't be knowing this. I shut it off. I mean, I really, you know, there's a wonderful line about the creative writing process from the wonderful Richard Bausch, excellent fiction writer, who said, if you think that you're thinking when you're writing, think again. He said, you're much closer to the dreaming side of your mind. So dream, dream, dream it through. And so if I find that I'm projecting ahead farther, you know, 2, 3, 4 chapters down, that means I'm thinking instead of dreaming. But when I'm just dreaming, again, and now what does that mean? Well, it means for me, I'm trying to be Tom Lowe this morning. I don't know what he's going to do. I don't know what's going to come his way today. And I have no agenda and I just follow him. And that's when it starts to dream and not think.
How are you able to turn it off? Because for me, I would think that would be very difficult to do. That's like somebody saying, you know, don't think about the purple elephant and you're going to think about the purple elephant. But also, in talking to many authors, we often ask the question of there's the writing of the book and there's the thinking of the book and thinking about the book, which seems like that thinking process would lend itself to maybe taking you further down the road with the headlight illumination than you want it to.
Yeah, I really do try not to think about the book when I'm not working on it in the morning. I'm a morning writer, but I feel it. And, you know, in the same way you would sublimate an inappropriate urge, like push that sucker down. You know, you sublimate it, to bring in Freud. You push it down in your psyche. And so I will, like, so what do? My practice is, and this has been for decades, and I'm grateful I can still do it. I get in my 2-3 hours, whatever, in the morning. Then I go to the gym or I hit the road running or on a bike. I do intense physical exercise for an hour or two just to sort of cleanse myself of the morning's dreaming. And then I feel myself sort of lock down all the story and progress into my psyche with an iron lock system. And I don't talk about it and I try not to think about it. Now, I'll be driving, going to the grocery store, and I'll hear a character's voice say something that I haven't written yet. Or I'll see the sliver of an image that I haven't seen yet or written yet. But I've learned over the years, like, you know, when I was a younger writer, I would write it down in a notebook or I would tape it in a tape recorder. I've learned over the years that I don't have to do that. I've learned that that's really the dream world speaking to you. You're not there yet. But it's not going to go anywhere. I don't have to record it. I don't have to write it down. It's going to show up. It might not be the next day's writing. It might be a week later. But again, this all sounds weird, right? Because what it's really about is excavating something that exists in another plane. You know, if you look at I love the phrase, it's an old one, right? But the story unfolded.
Right.
Think about that a second. The story unfolds. Well, that means the entire story is already tightly folded up into a, let's say, a cube, and you're opening it one panel at a time. And that's how it feels when the writing seems to be going well, Joe, that there's just a very careful opening of a panel. Oh, and this, oh, look at, and I guess, and this. And so again, it sounds, you know, new age voodoo, Ouija board weird, but when it's going well, and it felt like this for me with Tom Lowe and Such Kindness, is I'm just uncovering his world as it already exists in some other plane. And that's why I don't think about it. That's why I don't think about the book. I found if I just dream it. Now, let me say, once we're into the revision process, and once I'm, you know, going back and forth with my brilliant editor at Norton, Elaine Mason, there's a lot more thinking about the book. You know, we go to that brain. And that's when I allow the thinking for the heavy, heavy revision, of which I do endlessly. The revision process is a big, big thing for me.
Andre DeBuse III's new novel is Such Kindness. It is published by Norton. Andre will be part of the Provincetown Book Festival running in Provincetown, Massachusetts from September 20th through the 22nd. He'll be speaking on Saturday the 21st at 6 p.m. ProvincetownBookFestival.org for more information. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.